Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This story discusses sexual assault. Please take care while listening.
I stepped off the plane in Paris alone. There was no one waiting to greet me. No one holding a sign or flowers or balloons welcoming me to France. I would have to find my own way. It was September 1992, and I was 22 years old. I had left my hometown of Boone, Iowa, everyone and everything I knew, to live in Paris for the next year and work as a nanny, to experience all the City of Light had to offer, and to immerse myself in French after years of studying the language in high school and college. I wandered around the airport in Paris looking for somewhere to exchange my dollars into French francs, and I wondered, what was I thinking? But there was no turning back now. I took a taxi to the apartment where the woman I would be working for greeted me. Quintessentially French, she was tall and slender with dark eyes, dressed head to toe in black, perfectly coiffed and made up. She and her six-year-old daughter escorted me to my room on the top floor of the building, completely separate from the family's apartment. This tiny room with a ceiling that followed the roof's slope had brown walls, thin brown carpet, a twin-size bed, a sink, a wardrobe, and one small window. If I stood on my tiptoes, I could see the Eiffel Tower off in the distance. That room would become my sanctuary and my cell. When mother and daughter left, I filled the wardrobe with the few clothes that I had brought, including a single pair of running tights. I was an introvert who didn't make friends easily. I had struggled to fit in when my family moved to Boone in the middle of my fourth grade year. But at least I had my three siblings and my parents to support me. Mom showed her love with freshly baked chocolate chip cookies and brownies. Dad built me a desk and bookshelves, and he played basketball with my siblings and me. In college, finding and making friends took time, but with the built-in connections of life on campus, it came easier. I attended daily choir rehearsals, and I lived in the dorm with fellow resident assistants. Paris was different. I struggled with loneliness and homesickness. Every day, I forced myself to go out and see the sights of the city in the hours before my nanny duties began. I thrilled at visiting the iconic places that I'd only seen in movies or on TV. The Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame, Champs-Élysées, L'Arc de Triomphe. But I longed for someone to share it with, and I quickly grew tired of snapping photos of buildings. Afternoons spent playing Barbies with a six-year-old dragged on and on and on. Why don't we draw or color? Or maybe read a book, I suggested. No, she said, and handed me a Barbie, insisting that I change the doll's clothes yet again. Reprimands from her mother brought embarrassment and shame. This rice is overcooked. Or, don't wait for me to tell you to clear the table, Deborah. Or, you let her wear patent leather shoes and a white sweater to play at the park? Every evening, I returned to my room, alone and sometimes in tears, and wrote letters to my family, trying to downplay how miserable I felt most of the time. Finding community in Paris took persistence, but it happened. Within a few weeks, I started French classes at the Sorbonne, and I met other nannies from the States. One of them invited me to join her for a run to run after class at a track near the Eiffel Tower. I discovered the American Church in Paris. Sunday morning services and Wednesday evening choir rehearsals filled a void and brought a new circle of friends and familiar weekly rituals. I struck up a friendship with a woman my age in the choir. And things with the family got easier. The six-year-old and I got along better. I spent less time trying to persuade her to play something other than Barbies. After about 2 months in Paris, I finally felt like I was finding my way. But just as I was beginning to stitch together a community, my life was ripped apart. It happened the Saturday after Thanksgiving. Just 2 days earlier, I had been on the phone with my parents and siblings who were gathered around the table to celebrate the holiday without me. It had been my first holiday away from home. That Saturday, I woke to a cool, sunny morning and headed to the Bois de Boulogne for a run. This is a large park on the outskirts of Paris where I had run alone before. I loved going there because its tree-lined paths and wildness, compared to the manicured parks in the city, reminded me of a park just a few blocks from my home in Boone. The Bois de Boulogne offered a momentary escape from the constant noise of sirens blaring and horns honking, and from the smells of garbage, smoke, and fish. But on this day, all the light that I had come to appreciate about the park turned to darkness. As I finished my run, a stranger grabbed me, shoved me into nearby bushes, and sat on top of me. Underbrush dug into my skin. I twisted my legs and torso, trying to escape, and shouted for help. He slapped me across the face, hard. My glasses fell off. He put a filthy hand over my mouth. I gasped for air, the weight of him a boulder on my chest. And then he sexually assaulted me. When he finally stood up, I scrambled to my feet and ran back to the apartment, unable to see the reactions from the people that I ran past. I could taste blood, but I couldn't see my bloody nose or my bruised eye. I didn't notice the tears in my running tights. Unable to hide what had happened or to deal with it alone, I turned to the couple I worked for. Oh, mon Dieu, they both said. Qu'est-ce qui se passe? Oh, my God. What happened? He handed me a swig of whiskey. Later, he returned with me to the park to find my glasses. She listened as I described what happened and accompanied me up to my room to gather some clean clothes. I showered, wishing the hot water would wash away the morning's events. I wanted to curl up into a ball and disappear. To sleep the rest of the day, to try and forget, to be alone in my shock, my fear, and my shame. Instead, at the urging of the woman I worked for, I reached out to my community. I called my nanny friend and running partner. She came over and held me tightly as I sobbed. She listened. She encouraged me to call a rape crisis line and stood outside the phone booth as I dialed the number. We spent the rest of the day together wandering around Paris. It feels like everyone is staring at me, I said. Does my face look that bad? She said no, but suggested we slip into a movie theater for an afternoon matinee where I wouldn't have to worry about being stared at. That evening, she walked me back to the apartment, sensing my fear at returning alone. The next day, Sunday, I forced myself to get up and go to church. I needed the comfort and familiarity of the worship service. After the service, as we hung up our robes, my choir friend pulled me aside and asked me what was wrong. She had noticed my black eye, despite my best efforts to cover it with makeup. When I broke into tears, she escorted me to a nearby cafe and listened as I repeated my story. She listened to my questions. Why did this happen? Why would God let this happen? I have no memory of what she said, only that her willingness to step into my pain and to pray for me was a comfort to me that day. On Monday, the woman I worked for, who at this point had become much more than just my employer, accompanied me to the police station. She had insisted that I report the crime. Maybe someone else has reported too, she said. Your information could help the police find this man. In the days that followed, I went alone to appointments with a doctor and a psychologist, but I felt the support of those who I had told. The psychologist sat beside me when I called my parents to tell them a version of what had happened. Not wanting to worry them or to be forced to return home, I didn't tell them the whole story until years later. I stayed in Paris because I had made a year-long commitment to the family I worked for, and I didn't want to abandon them after only 2 months. Leaving would mean admitting defeat, failure. I wanted to prove to myself that I could make Paris home. After the assault, a canister of mace became my constant companion. I made sure I always had ID on me in case the police needed to identify my dead body. I begged God to keep me safe every time I walked out the door. And even though I was assaulted in broad daylight, my terror peaked at night, especially on the 5-block walk from the metro station back to the apartment after an evening out with friends. A distance that felt like miles, but was too short for taxi drivers to bother with. Determined to keep running, I had borrowed a needle and thread and stitched up the tears in my only pair of running tights. In the days and months that followed the assault, I gathered threads and stitched together a community. I welcomed other nannies to Paris and showed them around the city. I joined a young adult group at church, where I made connections with other people like me who were curious about their faith. When the family I worked for left town for a week, I invited friends over for dinner. Without having to worry about getting home safely, I could relax and enjoy the evening. We laughed at one another's attempts to flip crepes in a pan and told fish-out-of-water stories about living in Paris. In early spring, I traveled with friends to the painter Claude Monet's home in Giverny. We wandered through rows of irises, azaleas, and peonies, a painting of oranges, purples, reds, and every shade of pink. The pictures I took that day included not only the beautiful gardens, but also my friends. In May 1993, 6 months after the assault, I celebrated my 23rd birthday. That morning, I returned to the park where I'd been assaulted, this time with my nanny friend by my side. I wanted to prove to myself that I had the courage to return to the scene of the crime, that I was brave, that I had moved forward, and that the man who raped me hadn't stopped me from living. A dozen friends gathered for dinner and cake that evening. For me, it wasn't just a celebration of my birthday, it was a celebration of my becoming and of the community I had stitched together. As the group sang happy birthday, my heart burst open with joy. The morning I left Paris in August 1993, I threw my running clothes in a dumpster, including the running tights I had repaired months earlier. I was alone again, but I didn't feel alone. The community I stitched together in Paris wasn't born of convenience. It was born of time, effort, and a willingness to be vulnerable. I hadn't lost myself after the assault in Paris. I had discovered my own strength, resilience, and vulnerability. I had leaned into community and found myself. Thank you.
Just gonna run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan, from the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.